You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Delighted to see such a good turnout this afternoon. Thank you very much for coming. I'm Charlie Ebinger, the director of the Energy Security Initiative here at Brookings, and this report we're releasing today culminates nearly a, 15-month effort. You'll hear more about the methodology of what that really involved in terms of the types of people we met and where we went. I'm going to be joined on, I'm not going to read the bio since you have them, but we're going to be joined on the stage after a brief video with my colleagues John Banks, a non-resident senior fellow in our program, and Alyssa Shackman, an associate in our program as well. We three are the principal authors of the report. And Heather Connolly from CSIS has been shortly detained. She will be here. Has very kindly agreed to moderate this afternoon's session. For those of you that don't know Heather, she has a very distinguished public service record in the State Department, high up in the Red Cross, and, of course, at CSIS as director of their European program. You can see her full biography, but we're delighted because she is also a leading luminary on the Arctic, particularly during her years in the State Department. So without further ado, let us show a brief little video, which we hope you'll find amusing, that will introduce us to the subject today. Thank you.
Sort of kick off, for this research was that the U.S. is going to be assuming the chairmanship of the Arctic Council in 2015. So with that, we started to look at areas where the U.S. might be able to play a leadership role. Being the Energy Security Initiative, we looked at it from an energy security perspective. What we ended up finding was a lot of room for improvement in terms of offshore oil and gas governance. So we kind of kicked off our research from there. And then just to premise this a little bit, our research was not conducted with the goal of stating whether or not offshore oil and gas drilling is good or bad. It also did not, just for the sake of scope, we did not get into legal liability regimes, shipping, and a few other issues, just again for the sake of scope. So the background of our research, there's already a lot of literature out there on various topics related to the Arctic. And so we did an extensive literature review, and then to supplement that review, we also interviewed, I think, about 80 Arctic experts from the U.S., Canada, Russia, Finland, Sweden, a whole bunch that are all listed in the report, who gave us very just phenomenal advice and insight that we incorporated into our research. And at the end, the final analysis and the conclusions and recommendations we present are those of ESI alone. And the interviews that we did conduct, we conducted under the assumption that they would be confidential and would not be directly attributed. So you won't see any direct attributions for that purpose. So with that, I'll turn it over to Heather.
Well, Alyssa, thank you. And it's great to see such a wonderful turnout to talk about the Arctic. I always say it's a good day when we can have a good discussion about the Arctic. The weather has given us a perfect opportunity to think Arctic thoughts. It took me 20 minutes to get a cab in 20-degree weather. So as I thaw before you, I certainly welcome you. And thank you to Charlie, to John, and to Alyssa. First, thank you for inviting me into this conversation. That's a great privilege. And congratulations on a terrific, terrific report. I want to share, just if I may, very briefly before we dive into a conversation up here about the report, and then we want to welcome you into that discussion as well. I often say that we are really embarking on a new diplomacy. This is climate change diplomacy. This is economic diplomacy. And I think at its very heart, it's preventative and proactive diplomacy. Because what this report does, it's looking into the future. It's trying to provide stability, strengthen governance, norms, rule of law into a new area. Because this is a new ocean, which the five coastal states are trying to grapple with, where non-Arctic states are trying to grapple with, and indigenous peoples who are suffering every day from these changes are grappling with. So, my friends, welcome to a new world, and welcome to a very important report that helps us think through this new world. I held an event a month or two ago at CSIS, and one of our participants had a great line, so I'm going to share it with you. He said, you know, the Arctic isn't like Vegas. What happens in Vegas stays in Vegas. What happens in the Arctic doesn't stay in the Arctic. And I thought, oh, gosh, that's good. So I stole it. But it's absolutely true. So if there is an oil spill, heaven forbid, or an accident in the Russian Arctic, that affects the American Arctic in the Chukchi and the Beaufort Sea. So if we don't have standardization, harmonization, we can all do our thing in our exclusive economic zones. That's what international law and UNCLOS tells us. But what happens in one place impacts us. It impacts, in some ways, the global ecosystem because this transmits beyond the Arctic. So this is incredibly important. And so what we'd like to do with the remaining time that we have is talk and dive into some of the issue matters. Not only do we have a new diplomacy, but as of a few weeks ago, we have a new geopolitical shift with the Russian activities in Ukraine to throw into the mix here, and we want to talk about that as well. But just again, my opening thoughts, congratulations. It's a terrific report. It's all about American leadership in the Arctic, which is so important, and building that awareness because next May, the U.S. takes on a pretty big role. Not only the chairman of the Arctic Council, but the Arctic Council turns 20. The teenager has grown up and are about to be sent off into a new era, so we're ready for that conversation. So let me begin. And I want to sort of build the conversation out a little bit. I want to start, and what's so great about the report, it's very pragmatic. A lot of reports will come out and say, we need a new treaty, we need new governance. And this report says, now wait a minute, we've got a good level here. Let's be pragmatic. Let's see what we can do. And one of the recommendations I really liked was it was talking about how do we integrate the private sector. Because while governments and state oil and state-owned companies will be involved in Arctic development, it's going to be private companies that are going to be developing and thinking about oil and gas in the Arctic. So let me begin. Maybe I'll point at you, Charlie, first, but everybody jump in. So the private sector, and we're looking at economic trends, how much has U.S. unconventional oil and gas started to impact Arctic oil and gas trends? Because we don't see even Arctic development. We see Russia and Norway, very, very significant economic oil and gas development. In Greenland, we saw a little experimentation, perhaps not commercial viable. And in the United States, we're having a pretty big conversation about whether and if we'll explore those offshore resources. So I'd welcome your thoughts on how are the economic trend lines in global oil and gas impacting Arctic oil and gas exploration?
Well, thank you, Heather. There's no question that the unconventional oil and gas revolution, and particularly at the prices that we're developing unconventional gas, has had a dramatic impact on the Arctic, with people, I think, believing that the Arctic now probably is out another decade from what we might have thought before. At the extreme level, not to offend anyone if we have someone here from Total, but we've had statements out of the chairman of Total saying that it's at least 30 years away and kind of dismissively wondering if it is even beyond that. Okay. And in the course of our investigations, we had some other energy companies saying that when you talked about areas like East Greenland, that it was really a resource they would be looking at seriously in the 2030s. So a long way out. But that's not to say that we should, because of that, be complacent. We argue very strongly in our report, it's precisely because the activity in the broader Arctic is still at a fairly minimal level, that now is the time to make sure that we get the regulatory standards in place and standards that are Arctic-specific, not standards that may be fine for the Gulf of Mexico, but enhanced standards in the wake of what we learned out of the Macondo oil spill. And, you know, the 2030s sound like a long time away, but when you think about how long it takes even to develop a conventional energy project in the Gulf, you know, it can often be 5 to 10 years. So at 10 years, we're already, you know, at 2024. And so the 2030s aren't as far away as we think.
absolutely. I don't know if John, you want to...
Yeah, I would add a couple of things to that. I think there's two or three different streams of comments we heard from the private sector. First of all is that they are seeking a stronger role, and I think not just the industry itself, but a number of other stakeholders, that there needs to be a better way to integrate the private sector into the governance conversation. Now, that's happening. For example, the private sector, the companies participate in the development of ISO standards. The International Oil and Gas Producers Association, the OGP, has undertaken a number of efforts to look at strengthening standards in various areas. So the industry is taking steps, but they're looking for better, more meaningful ways to participate. That's one of the messages that we heard. And again, not just from the industry, but from a variety of stakeholders. Along the lines of whether or not these kinds of market developments like the lower 48 shale gas revolution and tight oil revolution will affect the Arctic, I think Charlie's absolutely right. I think it doesn't really make a difference whether there's going to be extensive commercial oil and gas, offshore oil and gas exploration in 10 years, 20, or 30 years. The idea is to get prepared now. And I think that's the lesson that comes out of Deepwater Horizon. And by the way, I think that theme, that message, is shared by the industry. The Deepwater Horizon Commission that looked at the accident, which was bipartisan and did have members of the industry on it, the Ocean Energy Safety Advisory Committee that was created by former Secretary Salazar, bipartisan committee, also had members of the industry on it, all agree, you know, so we need to put in place Arctic-specific, Arctic-tested standards, and that should happen now in advance of any extensive commercial drilling happening. So I think to a large degree that message was shared amongst a wide variety of stakeholders, as well as the message that there needs to be more meaningful private sector participation in strengthening the governance regime. Now, I just want to add that when we talk about industry response, it's not monolithic, right? We heard sort of different messages from different companies. Total stands out as having stated that they don't think that they can economically go after oil. Gas is another issue. So I think one has to be careful in trying to characterize general industry response. It's a little more nuanced than that.
Yeah, I would just add also that, you know, as John mentioned, there is already a lot of good industry participation out there sort of happening in pockets. The Norwegians are very proud of their involvement of the private sector, bringing them into all of their discussions when it comes to regulations and standards, et cetera. And even not just the Norwegian government, but other governments, too, do acknowledge that bringing the private sector into the discussion does add value, because at the end of the day, the private sector, the operators, are the ones out there working in the harsh conditions who know what's going to work, what's not going to work, and who have a lot at stake, because as Heather mentioned at the beginning, one accident there affects not only other regions, but the industry as a whole.
You know, and the tricky question here is, how do we plug the private sector in a meaningful conversation? I sometimes find that when talking about private sector, and now the Arctic Council has created an Arctic Economic Council, it's one of the new agenda items on the Canadian chairmanship, but I often find there's a disconnect, because for some, the private sector in the Arctic means business development and sort of the meet and greet and how do we connect industry with opportunity. What you all are talking about is making, you know, having the private sector not only tell governments and stakeholders what they see as the future trend line, 2030, 2040, 2050, so what we're seeing, but also how that their standards, what they've already been doing in the Arctic, can have a meaningful impact in shaping the policies that the Arctic Council or individual Arctic countries produce. I often hear some comments from industry. Number one, the Arctic isn't new. Hello, North Slope. We've been working there for decades. So there is experience. That's one common comment I hear. And then the other comment is, I'm not sure the government regulators fully appreciate the investment that this takes for oil and gas companies to look at these very difficult Arctic exploration. And then the drilling season is very short. So, I mean, I think in some ways these issues were raised with the Obama administration several years ago. They created a task force to streamline the licensing and process of that, but it's still not great. Secretary Jewell, in testimony today, said, well, you know, we're going to get to that. We're working on it. So we have some real questions here in the United States.
And the other interesting thing we heard vis-a-vis our own government, as we heard a number of private sector people, they weren't being critical, but they were saying they would welcome a lot greater access to some of our senior State Department officials.
Yeah.
They felt that oftentimes there was almost a feeling in the higher levels of state that it was unseemly is not the right word, but that it was inappropriate to be meeting with a particular company, perhaps out of concern that it could be perceived that they were getting some kind of favoritism at the expense of another company. But we heard a number of oil companies expressing concern that they did not feel they always had access to the highest councils of our own government, as they thought they had something to contribute to the debate.
Yeah. You had some recommendations, John, in the report about the Arctic Council and trying to perhaps either use the framework of the 8 members plus the permanent participants, the indigenous community, or perhaps plugging in directly. We know one of the Arctic Council working groups does focus on maritime, the safety and pollution standards. What were your reflections on how can the private sector, you know, that they may have some slight observer status maybe, but they're not able to plug into the premier forum for discussing these issues?
Right. Well, this falls into the category of sort of it depends on who you're talking to. You do get some feedback from the private sector that we would like to have a stronger role or at least some voice or some mechanism to work with, speak with, roll up our sleeves and have substantive discussions with the Arctic Council. The OGP did apply for observer status to the Arctic Council, but it didn't go through in the last round. This is a very simple mechanism or example of how private sector might be better integrated. So on the one hand, you do hear the companies say we would like to have some access and a way of participating, for example, with the Arctic Council. On the other hand, you also hear some private sector people say it depends on what we're doing with them or any group for that matter. It could be a waste of time. They want sort of meaningful interaction. So you do hear some people just sort of dismiss the Arctic Council as a waste of time for the private sector. But if they're given a meaningful mechanism to talk with and work with the Arctic Council, then they're interested. And I think the OGP is, for example, one as a trade association representing the national oil and gas producers, for one, is very interested in working with the Arctic Council. So it really depends. It's a very sort of nuanced view. It's not a monolithic response from the companies.
I think one of the frustrations, and you've articulated this very well in the report, feeling like we have some time. Time is on our hands here. You know, this 20, 30, yeah, we'll figure this out. Don't worry. And sort of the concern that, look, exploration is happening. It's now. Are we behind in creating the type of interaction and standards that we need, that need for speed? And you highlight that in the report. What's the message to policymakers? I mean, in think tank world, we have to be very provocative to move that needle just a little bit. So, Charlie, say something very provocative. What do we need to get our policy?
That's the right person to ask.
Exactly. It was a softball. Charlie, you know, how do we build some urgency into this? And I'll give you another example, and then I'll let you talk, and I'll shush. I really noticed, and this was a State Department initiative, to bring the 5 Arctic coastal states together to talk about potentially a regional fisheries policy in the central Arctic. Okay, there are no fish there. So that's great. That's preventative, proactive policy that says we may have a problem here. We need to talk about how, you know, as a moratorium, how we want to do our utmost. But on oil and gas, we're already there. We're doing it, and we're playing catch-up to how to do this. How do we build urgency into the debate?
Well, one of the themes we heard constantly, and I think it's a very telling theme, was the perception, is the U.S. an Arctic nation? And what we found is that actually there are public opinion polls that would alarm you on how many people say we are not an Arctic nation. Amazing numbers of people do not know we have a border on the Arctic. But that aside, we think there's a difference between thinking of ourselves as an Arctic nation in the sense that we have one major state, Alaska, that borders the Arctic and all kinds of issues arise in a purely Alaskan context, versus thinking of ourselves as an Arctic nation in the broader circumpolar north. Whereas precisely what Heather said in her introductory remarks, you know, we've got fish migrations moving from one jurisdiction to the another. We've got very likely the prospect if Shell's not drilling in the Chukchi Sea, we're very likely going to see drilling even this next season in the Russian sector of the Chukchi Sea. And as she pointed out, if there were an accident there and oil flowed into our territory, we have virtually very small capacity to deal with it. So we really have to start thinking about, are we an Arctic nation? Do we have strategic interests in the Arctic? We argue we do. And I'm not particularly talking about a military context. But one of the most telling observations I think we had was, I think I can say, from the head of the Coast Guard, who said to us, my worst fear is not having to deal with a major blowout of an oil and gas well in the Arctic once they're up there. My worst fear is that a cruise ship with 1,500 people on board hits an iceberg, is sinking, the president says, Admiral, you've got to do something, and I have to say, Mr. President, I have no capacity to do anything. Because the reality is there are no ports in Alaska, outside, way down in Dutch Harbor, almost 800 miles away from where Shell would have been drilling, is the nearest port of response. There's no land capability, so that if you could airlift people off a sinking ship, where are you going to put them? There aren't motels and hotels in these little coastal villages. We have to get serious when we start talking about, we have one icebreaker capable of operating in the Arctic at this point in time. The Russians have a number far greater.
25.
Each one is roughly costing $800 million. So when you start talking about, even getting 5 or 10, we're talking serious money. Having a presence in the Arctic cannot be done on the shoestring budget that we have pretended and continue to pretend we can do it on. But we have to first have a consensus. And most notably on Capitol Hill, where knowledge of the Arctic is unfortunately very low, about the resources that are needed and whether we can generate the political capital on both sides of the aisle to start effecting those, so that 10 years from now, we really do have a capability to deal with some of the challenges that are going to confront us.
I could just add a thought to maybe tie a few issues together here. So part of this is the resources are there. The receding ice cap is allowing greater access to those resources. The coastal states' governments have largely established policies to exploit those resources, favorable to and promoting the exploitation of those resources. And there's commercial interest in those resources. And then we've talked about the nature of the Arctic with its transnational, transboundary issues, pollution in one area, affecting that in another area. But the issue is that a lot of this commercial interest is moving into areas that are ice-laden and have different environments. Yes, it's true there's been activity certainly in the Arctic onshore and some offshore and the near offshore over the last several decades. But what's different is it's moving further north into different conditions and in ice, more ice-infested waters. And so what you see and what you hear, and this, again, goes across a wide array of stakeholders, is the need for Arctic-tested or Arctic-specific standards. Issues related to seasonal and area drilling, issues related to polar-class vessels, enhanced pipeline infrastructure, training, human resources development to handle the Arctic environment, et cetera. This is what many are focused on in terms of strengthening the governance regime, and that is necessary as you move into these newer areas. Now, what complicates that is the Arctic isn't just the Arctic writ large. It is full of different regions and subzones that are different. Within the Barents Sea itself, there's something like 20 or 30 different classes of ice pack, right? So this calls into question whether or not you can put in some sort of governance regime that is addressed to the Arctic writ large, or whether it's more specific to a zone or a particular region. And you will hear the companies and others, not just the companies, argue that it makes more sense to have regional or targeted governance standards and other regulations targeted to those specific areas. Lastly, even with strengthened standards in these areas, and we now have, as the video said, the Arctic Council helped shepherd into being an Arctic oil pollution agreement. That's great if you have that in place and if you have the standards in place. But if you don't have the infrastructure in place, how are you going to enforce it and carry it out? We heard this from industry. President Grimson of Iceland highlighted this at the Arctic Circle conference last fall and to us in person. We heard this from indigenous representatives. It's great to have a search and rescue agreement and an Arctic oil pollution agreement, but if you don't have the infrastructure, what good is it? And so that's why the other piece of this governance approach is the sort of resource sharing approach. And Tommy Boudreau has talked about this in developing Alaska-specific standards. How do you get industry and government to work together to ensure that you have the assets in place to at least give you the operational capabilities to implement whatever standards you have? We had one person tell us, a very senior former government, U.S. government representative, saying the emphasis actually should probably not be as much on the standards themselves, but on the infrastructure to get the standards operational. And so that's another take on this, that it's not just the standards, but it's the infrastructure to actually make them operational.
So you make a very bold, you make several bold recommendations. One, check the box. You argue for an Arctic ambassador, Arctic envoy. It's actually going to be an Arctic special representative, we're told. We're all anxious to hear who that individual will be. So do you think putting a point person and a U.S. special representative, in addition, you also recommended, hey, we want this topic, we want oil and gas governance at the top of the U.S. chairmanship of the Arctic Council. Tell me a little bit structurally, if this is where it's the best thing to be a think tank, because we can think about how we would design it in a perfect world, and then we can watch if that's actually practical. But how would you had some really good, interesting recommendations on structure, on individuals, and on agenda items. I'd love for you to talk about them a little bit more.
Well, I'll add briefly, we did recommend having an appointed Arctic ambassador. Check the box.
The power of Brookings. Got that one.
It's all us. And, but then we also recommend creating a regional bureau for polar affairs within the State Department, so it doesn't just fall on one person, going to all these meetings where it's a lot of big talk and not so much nitty-gritty details. We think that establishing a more robust group of folks who focus on the Arctic, on both Arctic sides, but not just necessarily on oil and gas issues, but in general on the region, would help sort of unify this sort of bifurcated approach we're taking right now to looking at the Arctic, depending on which agency you're talking to.
John? Some people may say the last thing we need is another regional bureau in the State Department. But the reason we argue for that is, and we heard a lot of people, from a lot of people, including former State Department officials, who argue that in the past, Arctic affairs have been seen as technical issues, not as strategic issues that would belong in one of the more politically oriented bureaus. We heard stories that even in things like the Office of Canadian Affairs, that there really wasn't a polar expert. It was over in the Economic and Business Bureau. And as I say this, I want to give the highest praise to the Arctic officials we do have in the State Department, because they do yeoman service and, in fact, work far beyond their the hours of the day that they probably have in front of them. But we just feel that as long as it's seen as a technical issue, it's not going to go up to the level at the assistant secretary or above until we have a crisis, obviously, of some kind or another. So we feel an office directed to polar affairs, and it wouldn't just be the Arctic, but would include the Antarctic, is very important. We also realize we can't be committing new positions all over the U.S. government, but perhaps in one or two other locations, we might want someone who's extremely knowledgeable about polar affairs with that designation as their primary order of activity. We think until you get that, they're going to remain fairly modest issues down the line. And as I say, it will only be when we have a crisis that it will get elevated higher up into the Bureau. Now, obviously, the State Department is only one part of the component. We obviously have a lot of very knowledgeable people working. Some of you may be here today working in the Interior, EPA, and other Homeland Security on these issues. But we really feel that as the lead agency in our international orientation towards the Arctic, again, believing that we have circumpolar Arctic interests, not just Alaskan interests, it really is incumbent on state to elevate the role of polar affairs in the department.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, in the administration's defense, my goodness, there have been a flurry of strategic documents that have been coming out, big, thick ones, and from the Defense Department. And the Navy upgraded its Arctic roadmap, and we had this very detailed White House implementation plan. So sort of the counterpoint is, my gosh, we're doing an amazing amount of work on the Arctic. So, you know, again, in the flurry of the strategies and the documents, Charlie, I think you're absolutely right. I think we have a structural problem here. There's an extraordinary complexity to U.S. policymaking towards the Arctic. 22-plus federal agencies have a hand and a role in it, and I'm not even at the state level. And obviously, the state of Alaska has an enormous role here. So this is very, very complex, and I think we've all been trying to scratch at this this organizational component to it. But it has real impact on the U.S. chairmanship, because everyone has and some items that they would like on the top of their list. If I had my wish list, yours is oil and gas governance. Mine is shipping, getting to the one of the questions you didn't hit, because I think the Arctic safety factor, whether that's oil tankers, cruise ships, fishing vessels, you name it, shipping is a real key. But the structural challenge, and it gets also back to how does the private sector, where do you plug in? Do you go to the Department of Interior? That's where you normally plug in. Or do you go to the State Department for the international
issues? But even within these strategic documents, and I commend the administration for having so much focus on these, there are some striking differences. I mean, for example, you take the DOD document, Arctic Strategy, as opposed to, say, the Coast Guard's. The Coast Guard, I would say, is a visionary, forward-looking document. It is essentially saying these problems that we're talking about, maybe not here and now, but they aren't far down the road. And we've got to really act. We've got to commit resources for more ships, so forth. The DOD document is far more complacent. You know, it talks about we got to be sure that, you know, the ice really is melting as fast, that these will be concerns, but, you know, maybe they're concerns down the road a little bit. We've also got to be assured that we don't rush in and put a lot of money into the Arctic that may take away valuable resources from other pressing military theaters around the globe. I mean, if you read the two documents side by side, I'm not doing it very poetic justice here, it really is striking the difference of tone. And I would say to some extent the Navy's is much closer to DOD's. Than the Coast Guard. The Coast Guard is really out there, and I think probably demonstrates that they are on the front line, certainly in Alaska and elsewhere, in dealing with these resources under very constrained budgets.
What? The last word, budgets. and I think that is what we're grappling with, because we're seeing new challenges but not making the resource allocation. Is there, John, is there a budget issue related to sort of getting an oil and gas governance framework, strengthening it? I mean, we're talking about what's the venue for the private sector to engage more completely? What are the infrastructure costs? I mean, this is where the strategic rubber meets the budget road, and we haven't met it yet.
Yeah, we did not look at numbers related to what it would take to put in place the infrastructure that I was talking about before, in terms of the prepositioning of assets and equipment in order to complement the actual regulations in place and as they change, complementing them. And as Charlie mentioned, individual icebreakers are close to $1 billion a piece, et cetera. So we didn't dive in necessarily to the budget, although it clearly is an issue if you're going to preposition those assets and build the infrastructure to support the governance regime. So I think that's the part where the role of the Congress and budget issues are critical to supporting what we're recommending. In terms of the creation of the Polar Bureau and the ambassador, you know, in our discussions, both with high-level U.S. officials who deal with the international community as well as those we spoke with in the international community, similar questions come up all the time. What is the U.S. policy? What is your approach? Who do I deal with? What do you think of this issue? What do you think of that issue? And constant questions about when are you going to accede to UNCLOS, when are you going to do this, when are you going to do that, are you serious about Arctic policy? This is the reaction from the international community, the coastal states, the Arctic Council states, to the U.S. position. So I think part of what we're getting at in those higher level recommendations on the ambassadorship and the Polar Bureau is to provide that institutional structure and that face, not just internally but externally.
Mm-hmm. How much, what I'm struck in the infrastructure and the pre-positioning part, and I, going back to the Coast Guard strategy, a lot of this is science and understanding the climatic, the environmental changes, the severity of the storms, the shifting of the sea ice. It has real, really important implications for standardization, whether that's in platform construction, spill response, maintenance. How much does, again, the science factor, helping NOAA with the satellite maritime domain awareness, help us understand where that plays in? Because I know the private sector, they do fund a lot of this science. The oil and gas companies would say, hey, I'm almost as big as Uncle Sam when it comes to supporting the understanding of what's going on. And, of course, the National Science Foundation, other agencies play a huge role in understanding this. How did that play into your conversations? I'll let first person today go look at it.
Yeah, well, we did hear from, remembering one interview in particular, that, you know, when we're talking about leadership roles for the U.S., where are these gaps? And right now in the Arctic Council where the U.S. can plug itself, it's research and R&D. You know, the U.S., we might have a debilitating bureaucracy and political system and, you know, these convoluted standards and, you know, all of that. But what we do very well compared to the international average, I guess, is science and research and funding that goes into that R&D. So that was something that did come out. And I think, you know, again, this would be sort of a next step past this report. I think with this report, we're just trying to say, if anything, the first step is to educate people. There is a lack of knowledge on what's going on in the Arctic. So, you know, with this, take it and run with it, you know, and see where we can start putting these fundings and, you know, the numbers and the budgeting. Like John said, we didn't get into those details. But I do think that bringing in science into the Arctic Council could be one of the avenues.
I was astounded, personally, I guess it was my own ignorance, but to realize how much of the Arctic waters and subarctic waters in parts of Alaska aren't even adequately charted. I mean, that's the basic questions of depth. When you look at something like the Bering Strait, you know, a little over 50 miles, and there's not even agreements on egress and coming in and out and ship channels, and still not complete information according to the Coast Guard of, where rocks are on either side of the straits. NOAA does wonderful work, but I think, too, relative to the need, is probably vastly underfunded. I know everything's underfunded, but I think we have to get serious because, you know, one major accident up there and people are going to have a completely different view of whether we should be there at all. If I could just digress to one moment, your interest in shipping. I think one thing that came out in our report, although it wasn't the focus, is we actually think as the Arctic opens up that it's probably going to be minerals that are far faster in being developed and more cargoes as these various polar routes open up participating in that. We were staggered in when we were in the extreme north of Scandinavia to see the size of mining investments in northern Norway, Sweden, Finland, and on in the Karelia region. I mean, we're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars of investments underway right now or planned in the next year or two. In the northern Canadian islands, when we sat up in Ottawa, it was staggering when all of a sudden they showed us a map and all the minerals that were being developed on scores of islands up there. So this is where, and that will, of course, be a major problem as we have more and more ships traversing through these dangerous waters if we don't have adequate information as to water depths, rocks, and so forth.
Yeah, and one figure, I think the Arctic has been hydrographically mapped to only 8% of international standards. That's pretty pretty surprising number. I think you're absolutely right. It's in the near term, mineral resources. I mean, some of the largest mines, zinc, iron ore, rare earths potential, which is what's getting everyone's attention in Greenland potentially, Iceland perhaps. You're absolutely right. These are the geoeconomics of the Arctic, as we like to argue, is shaping the issue very profoundly.
The other interesting observation, and it was only one or two companies, but it's quite startling on the one hand to hear a statement, well, the Arctic is 30 years away. On the other hand, when you talk to some of the shipping companies in places like Finland, Now, obviously, that's not a coastal state, but it makes a huge percentage of the vessels that actually go into the Arctic. You hear these people thinking this is the next generation of their business, and they aren't talking the next generation being 30 years, probably being 10 years. So, you know, on the shipping side, and you hear at a big conference in Reykjavik, I was startled to hear major shipping companies start, as you talk about a transpolar shipping route as opposed to the Northwest Passage or the Northern Sea route along Russia. People seriously looking at Iceland as being a place that could become a major center for transpolar activity, or even places like that most people don't even know where they are. The Faroe Islands looking at as that area of the Earth develops commerce as the ice opens up, becoming a major repair facility for all kinds of ships that would transit through the transpolar corridor. So the shipping industry seems to believe things are happening faster than at least some parts of the oil and gas industry.
Absolutely.
And a lot of those companies we talk to in the shipping side are companies that support the oil and gas industry. And what they're telling us is they're preparing now for that expected increase in commercial activity, not just in the oil and gas sector, but including it.
Right, absolutely. Talk to Finnish ice-breaking companies, Korean companies that are building ice-hardened LNG tankers and things like that. You're absolutely right. We can see the future a little bit by their order books. One, we'll stay on shipping, and I'm transitioning here a little bit. It is very clear that for the Russian government, the Northern Sea Route is going to be a significant transit corridor, not only for what we call destination shipping, which is going up to get the mineral resources, the oil and gas from the Russian Arctic, the Norwegian part of the Arctic, but potentially transshipment through the Northern Sea Route. And I think we're all curious, cautious, concerned what developments in Ukraine mean for the Arctic and our cooperation. I think we all agree the Arctic has been an amazing area of cooperation with Russia. Some of the most significant advances in the Arctic Council, which is the search and rescue agreement using the framework, was because U.S.-Russian co-leadership for the oil spill and response agreement. It was Norwegian-Russian-U.S. trilateral leadership of that. And we note this week the senior Arctic officials are meeting in Canada, so I think everybody showed up, so that's good. We're still talking through it. We're completely speculating. I have no idea, but I'd love your thoughts on how does this shift in Russian behavior, sanctions by the United States, Europe potentially, what's the impact in the Arctic, and particularly the oil and gas sector, which for Russia, considering the enormous investment of Rosneft, of Novatek, so the Gazprom, the biggest companies, Igor Sessions' strong role in Arctic development. This is very important to Mr. Putin. What will he? How will this pan out?
Well, yeah, this is pretty good timing for our report, since one of our recommendations is to work more closely with Russia on Chukchi Sea issues. So two thoughts. One is I would certainly hope that this atmosphere of tension right now doesn't deteriorate anymore. But more specifically, I would hope that it would not affect the relationship on issues like this, like talking about our shared marine environment with the Chukchi Sea. One of the things we heard in Alaska and from the Coast Guard is that there are longstanding sort of peer-to-peer coordination and arrangements with the Russians that have been going on for quite a long time, on issues regarding law enforcement, fisheries, even to some extent on oil and gas. I think we mentioned in here that the MMS, the old Mineral Management Service, has had a relationship dating back to the early 90s and the Soviet Union days, working on oil and gas governance issues. But what we heard from the Coast Guard and others in Alaska is that there are these sort of working arrangements, not on a high-level diplomat-to-diplomat level, but on a sort of working arrangement level, that have been taking place for quite a long time. And these go on every day, these kinds of communications. Just pick up the phone and talk to your counterpart across the strait. And that's one reason why we like this sort of neighborhood approach, which is to tackle governance issues in your shared marine environment with your neighbor, because obviously what happens on one side of the Chukchi is going to affect what happens on the other side. So this all to say that I would certainly hope that tensions around sort of Crimea and Ukraine wouldn't divert attention away from the need to continue to talk to the Russians on these sort of peer-to-peer networking neighborhood-like issues, including on oil and gas governance, and not have that take our ball off the importance of the oil and gas side, as well as the range of other issues that we speak to the Russians on a day-to-day basis.
Charlie?
Well, as you probably saw, it already has had some, the Ukraine has had some impact because in the case of Novatek, one of the persons who was sanctioned by our government was a substantial holder and has now had to divest his interests, which may be up for grab by others, and sent Novatek stock plummeting. So there has been some rippling effect. It's clear to me that Mr. Putin sees the Yamal Peninsula, the Kara Sea, and the ocean farther east as the future of Russia. He's given speeches. You can see chapter and verse. Both his Arctic advisor and his great polar explorer advisor, whose name is eluding me at the moment.
Schillinger.
Thank you. Spoke at conference in Iceland, and they very dramatically showed that their vision of the future as Russia developed all these its natural gas reserves, particularly in that it would be able to ship east or west. And they saw them playing a vital role in the world, and they mentioned the world LNG market, not a fragmented LNG market. And Putin has made other speeches hyping the same theme. I get a little concerned by some of the hysteria about Russian military deployments in that part, because the reality is, as John was alluding to, the Russian military is probably one of the few groups that actually has a capability to effect things like search and rescue and oil spill prevention and response if something occurred. I mean, we all know Russia is a highly militarized society, but, you know, this doesn't mean that they're going to necessarily try to do a land grab of the oceans up there, although, of course, we have the famous story of the flag being planted. So I think we just need to, without diminishing the significance of the Ukraine, or particularly if the crisis spread, I think John's right. On a long-term basis, it's in the interests of both nations, particularly in areas of the Chukchi, where we share a border, but even more broadly. I mean, Putin has to know also that he does not have the technological capacity to develop his Arctic regions without the help of our great oil companies and those in Western Europe and elsewhere that have the capacity to operate in those environments. So I think hopefully this won't degenerate into something where we have a major crisis with contracts that have already been signed not being honored. I think that would be a disaster for both parties, but we have to wait and see what happens.
In terms of sort of cooperation, U.S.-Russia cooperation, I would also encourage sort of this divide in thinking of what goes on at the top diplomatic level. We're talking at U.S. administration and Mr. Putin, military side. You can think of that on one level, but then one level down is where you have, you know, the head of the U.S. Coast Guard calling up his counterpart over in Russia and having this very, we hear from both sides, a very productive, cooperative sort of working arrangement that they have. And so keeping these two levels distinguished a little bit, I think, is really important given everything that's going on right now. Another thing, too, is, you know, we don't really know what Russia's plans are. You know, what we have an idea what their capabilities are, et cetera. But, you know, on one example, you mentioned they have 25 icebreakers. I also heard someone on a lower, more working level from Russia say that, you know, a lot of those are going to be retiring in the next few years, and they're not giving us money to build any more to replace them. So, you know, I think there is one thing to sort of see what they're putting out there as statements of their presence, of their strength, and another to sort of take a step back and think, okay, well, what does this really mean operationally?
Yeah. You might want to move to the floor.
That's exactly. Yeah. I love it when he thinks right where I'm going to go, because I could keep this going all day, but we want to bring you into the conversation. So we have some microphones around. If you could raise your hand, please let us know your affiliation. And you have the firing squad up here, so fire away. Yes, sir, right down the front.
Have a mic?
Yep, right down here. Thank you. Thank you.
Hugh Haskell from the
Could you identify yourself, please?
Yeah, Institute for Energy and Environmental Research.
Thank you.
It was 50 years ago about that we implemented the Antarctic Treaty, which had some pretty strong articles about how the Antarctic area could be developed. And given that the conditions between the Antarctic and the Arctic are dramatically different, what lessons can we learn from how that treaty has played out over the last five decades?
I just frame before I unleash you that, again, remember the difference between Antarctica, it's land surrounded by waters, and, of course, the law of the sea is the governance, the international legal framework for the Arctic, because it is water, ocean surrounded by land. So in some ways, just a point of clarification, but I'll let you know.
I would just say that when the Antarctic Treaty went into effect, and, of course, we had a number of countries that made territorial claims, some based on historic exploration, some based on elongation from their southern borders straight to the South Pole. But it was generally deemed that the area was so sensitive ecologically, we realized that a huge volume of the krill that get thrown out by the current system into the ocean and are so important in global marine life around, literally around the globe, that this was probably an area, since there was no immediately perceived need for resources, that we got the countries to agree in terms of most resources, but certainly oil and gas, of putting their claims into abeyance. Didn't mean they gave them up, but they agreed to place them into abeyance as long as the treaty remained in effect. And, of course, the treaty gets, I think it's every 5 years, I may be off on that, gets ratified. So I think the consensus still is that that's probably the best thing to do with the Antarctic, continue to have major scientific exploration of the region, but don't touch the very sensitive marine and fish life. Now, does that have applicability for the Arctic? I guess if you're somebody that believes that in the final analysis, we shouldn't be drilling for oil and gas up there at all, and there are certainly people, maybe some in the room, who legitimately believe that and have argued that persuasively in some scientific and academic journals. Our feeling is, as we say, we don't support or not support. We say the cat's out of the bag, and rather than pretending that it's not and that we can put it back in, we think it's better to try to come up with some strong rules that will make it that make any development be done as sensibly as possible.
Well, building from that question, building on one of our findings in this research, is that there is this discussion about whether you can have a sort of Arctic-wide treaty, and specifically whether you can have an Arctic-wide oil and gas governance framework that just blanketly covers the Arctic. And I would say that mostly what we heard from the stakeholders we talked to is that it's better to build on what you already have in the governance framework rather than trying to create something from scratch. So we have a graphic in the report that sort of shows how the current governance framework is structured, right? You have the coastal states with national regulations and standards. You have some international legal instruments like UNCLOS and some others. You have bilateral mechanisms, regional mechanisms. And you have a set of voluntary instruments, ISO standards, trade association, best practices, things like that. So you have this kind of multi-layered governance approach with all these components to it. And the sum of those parts equals the governance regime. And so what we heard was it's probably more appropriate and a better use of time to strengthen those individual pieces, and that the sum of strengthening those pieces equals strengthening the entire structure, rather than trying to create a new regime altogether. And so that's why our recommendations sort of target, you know, working with Canada on a bilateral basis, working with Russia on a bilateral basis on our respective shared marine environments to strengthen the governance regime, and working with the Arctic Council, trying to strengthen the Arctic Council's efforts in oil and gas at the regional level, so that we have these selected recommendations to try to address some of these pieces, not all of them, but some of these pieces. Acceding to UNCLOS would be one that addresses the piece that's the international component. So I think that's the thrust of our recommendations, is to try to build on the existing governance framework and target these individual pieces and strengthen the whole that way.
You want to add anything to that?
No, I think you guys covered everything. Just one quick note maybe is that, sort of going off of what John was saying, the other effective sort of component of working in smaller bits and focusing sort of more on bilateral or regional mechanisms is that a lot of what we heard across the board, depending on who we interviewed, was that when you start to go for more institutionalized, overarching agreements, what you end up getting out of it, like the guidelines that the Arctic Council released in 2009, some of the authors of it told me this, they said, it's just the least common denominator. What ends up getting put in there isn't necessarily what's most important, and what is put in there isn't addressed properly. So
very pragmatic. John, yes, right down in the middle.
John Farrell, a U.S. Arctic Research Commission. Two of the recommendations in the report have a link, and Heather touched on this, and one was strengthening the Arctic Council without changing the mandate. And the second one was involving private industry to a greater extent. And as Heather mentioned, the ministers at the last ministerial asked that a circumpolar business forum be established, also referred to as an Arctic Economic Council. In light of that, how would you, if you were tasked with creating that, how would you do it? And what would you consider in terms of who would be on the forum? What mandate would they have? How would they engage with the ministers? And how would you balance concerns from other parts of civil society, such as ENGOs, that might be quite nervous about private sector having special access to ministers?
Oh, that John Farrell, he asked the toughest questions. All right, the gauntlet has been thrown down. How would you were advising the Arctic Council on what the Arctic Economic Council must do. What should it do?
We asked that question of a counterpart that was involved in this. My understanding is that it's still proceeding in terms of its structure. It's not completely decided yet. Their response was that it's an incredibly difficult task, it really encompasses trying to get everybody involved, the indigenous communities, what kinds of businesses are you talking about, and how do they have meaningful input into that forum. And on the private sector side, we heard, yeah, we're interested in this, but no one's come to us yet. And they were a little frustrated that it was proceeding without the private sector being at the table from the outset. Now, that's based on a few interviews. Maybe that's not a large enough data set. But I think that's one of the challenges, is how you get the right people at the table from the outset, and in particular the private sector. And I think that's the whole crux of the matter. You have to find the right structure, the right people, and the right mechanisms to get them talking. And that's the challenge. I mean, that's not an answer to your question, but I mean, that's what they're struggling with, and when we asked them that they were struggling with it.
I think we don't know what we want it to do. This gets back to what is the mission of this? Is it to have a cocktail party for industry on occasion in the Arctic Circle? Is it...
Not a bad idea.
Well, I'd go. Is it about industry helping to inform and shape and educate Arctic governments about what they're seeing, what they need, what guidance, what regulations, what standardization do they need? So is it a two-way street? Is it a one-way conversation? And I quite frankly, John, your question is absolutely spot on. And even if there was clarity going through the last year of the Canadian chairmanship, this is going to fall right in the American chairmanship. And what are you doing with this again? And how are American companies going to work? This is really, really, I think, one of the key questions as the Arctic Council is coming of age. It's, I think, how you integrate the private sector in a meaningful way, and then how do you integrate non-Arctic actors, the permanent observers that were decided, how in the world do you integrate them more fully into the Arctic Council without particular Arctic Council members feeling that that's not a good thing to have.
Well, so the first thing you do is hire John Farrell as your consultant.
I agree. Step one.
No, but on a serious note, I just want to state very strongly, you must have the indigenous peoples represented and not have this just kind of be industry of what, and we can argue about which industry should be there, industry talking to the governments. The natives have to be there and have to be there with very strong representation. At the most superficial level, I would agree with you, Heather. The most important thing would be to have the respective people representing industries be people who could talk about the real-life problems they are encountering, whether they're in mining, oil and gas, shipping, tourism, whatever. To have those views, I think, heard very strongly by people in the Arctic Council. But to move beyond that, or how you keep, because you're already, if you're talking about five or six industries and indigenous peoples, you're already talking about a rather unwieldy group. Maybe you can have subgroups, but it's a good question we need to think about because we don't obviously have a good answer for it.
One thing that we talk about a lot in our paper or brief is sharing best practices. So that might be a good approach in sort of going into it. And in terms of what industries you invite, you know, if you want to start small and work your way out, I think starting with those who are present there now, not the ones who say, hey, we will be interested in the region when things are developed, but starting with the operators who are there now, sort of giving them a platform to just share all their best practices and then invite indigenous groups or whomever has a stake in these things to sort of review and be aware of what's going on.
It's a huge challenge. Yes, sir, we have one up here. Microphone is coming.
That's a good question.
There we are. Right here. Thank you.
I'm Jim Tozzi with the Panarctic Forum. I compliment you on your statement on the regulatory regimes that are dominant in the Arctic, and you stated that there was one group of people that you spoke with preferred the U.S. regulatory regime, which is very prescriptive. Then you mentioned another group of people that supported the performance-based regulatory regime, which was advocated by Norway. And later in your report, you said you'd spoke to people, and there was the fact that some of them said that the U.S. did not support some strengthening of the Arctic Council. And I was wondering if that divide was in any way related, or that concern was any way related to the difference in regulatory governance procedures between the use of prescriptive standards versus performance standards.
Who would like that one?
I think I would say that they were somewhat separate. As we mentioned in the report, there's this school of thought that thinks that the Arctic Council should be strengthened in terms of changing its legal personality to have sort of more teeth and to make it, in effect, more of a treaty-based organization. And that was the theme and a debate that ran through our discussions. In the context of that particular discussion, the issue of prescriptive versus performance standards didn't come up as much. It had more to do with whether or not people thought the Arctic Council was certainly running well the way it's currently crafted, and you would really lose those advantages if you changed its legal personality. That was sort of a separate discussion. The discussion around the performance standards versus prescriptive standards, clearly it's moving towards performance standards, and even the U.S. government and DOI is looking at that now. Canada is also looking at that. And it seems to be moving in that direction, or at least in some hybrid fashion. And I think that largely, certainly industry felt strongly that that was the right way to go, that performance standards provide more of an incentive for innovation, and innovation in technology is exactly what you need as you're moving into the Arctic. So I think the short answer to your question is those discussions were somewhat separate. We didn't see the approach to standards as part of the discussion on what the Arctic Council should look like.
Great, super question. Other questions? We have one in the back, right in the middle, in the back, right there. First we have to find you, then we have to get the microphone to you, and then you're all set. Caroline.
Caroline Roloff here from CSIS. Thank you for a great presentation. My question regards a little bit more the leadership role the U.S. should play in the Arctic, specifically strategic objectives. And in light of everything that's happened in Ukraine, and you guys did touch on this a bit, there's been quite a bit of discussion in Europe regarding their energy dependence on Russia and how Europe can perhaps change that. And there's, of course, been a growing debate here in the U.S. on exporting gas and oil to Europe. And while that's not perhaps an immediate solution, it's still a ways in the future. I wonder, could current sort of geopolitical transformations affect the U.S.'s strategic goals in the Arctic? Could this transform how the U.S. looks at the Arctic region? And perhaps could this also provide the political initiative to Congress or other government agencies to address the Arctic more directly and, you know, develop more perhaps cohesive policies?
It's one big plug for a lot of Norwegian gas to go to Europe, potentially. Charlie.
The reality is lots of people thought that as we developed our shale gas and no longer needed LNG, that our LNG, the LNG that had been destined for the United States, could now move to Europe, putting great pressure on long-term contracts with Gazprom. And there's still people writing as if that has happened, when nothing could be farther from reality. If you look at numbers for 2013, in reality, gas exports to Europe from Norway, from the Netherlands, and Algeria all fell. And Russian gas exports, this is before Ukraine, rose about 13%. And I think most people believe that with European, first of all, European gas demand is projected to be flat by most analysts for certainly the rest of this decade and possibly substantially longer. Russia will, from a purely commercial standpoint, be able to probably undercut the price of any LNG that could come in. Now, if Europe decides, or Eastern Europe decides for strategic reasons, they're willing to pay a higher price, well and good, but keep in mind that one of the problems we have in Ukraine is that you have very low retail prices, so consumers are probably not willing to pay more, and retail prices, sadly, are so low, even though Ukraine has tremendous opportunities for energy efficiency, there's no financial incentive to do that. So I think if one can step back, and I hate to do that because I tend to be hawkish of these matters. I was telling my wife we should have another Abraham Lincoln Brigade like we had in Spain going to Ukraine, somewhat jokingly. But I think the reality is that Russian gas is going to be able to penetrate the European market to the extent there is a market, and it's not going to be a dynamic market. It's going to be more that unless Norway's found some new fields, if that can get their production back up over time, well and good. But LNG is going to have a hard time competing against pipeline gas from Russia for a very long period of time. Does it affect our Arctic strategic interests? I don't believe so, because there is at least the potential of the Arctic as one of the last great frontiers. Ironically, with all the technological problems that you have in the Arctic that we've talked about in our report, one thing that came through very loudly from almost all the energy companies we talked to is they saw that technological risk as less than the political risk of their standard places they buy oil and gas from around the world, with the rise of national oil companies being denied access to bidding or to new acreage when it pops up around the world. That was very interesting. That was almost across the board, that we can handle the technological risk, can't handle the political risk as well. So I personally think Russia will emerge as a major player, even bigger than it is today, with LNG going east and west from the Arctic. If we're looking 20 years out, they have tremendous shale oil resources in the west of the Urals, which at some point they could develop if they need to do so. All kinds of reasons you can argue why they haven't been able to do that, may continue not to be able to do that. But Russia is a resource giant, and it's not going away.
Charlie, if I can follow up, and this is more of a domestic question on Alaska. Certainly North Slope production going down, sort of questions about where exploration could happen within federal government lands in Alaska. Isn't this a really important issue, whether there's offshore exploration in Chukchi and the Beaufort, new production for Alaska, and again on the oil side for the Trans-Alaskan Pipeline? Don't we have a little bit of urgency within the state of Alaska on figuring out what their future pictures? I'm far from expert, but I'm just reading.
We have great urgency, and it's been absolutely ridiculous, the debate that we've had on the Keystone Pipeline, when TAPS is far more vital to our national security in terms of keeping the flow of oil through that.
Yikes.
Now, you know, if you look at where Shell was drilling, even if Shell had found something, you know, it's pretty difficult to get it from there to TAPS, pipeline across very difficult terrain. But unless you want to get serious, and this will be controversial, and let's really assess what may be in the National Petroleum Reserve. Let's really assess. I didn't say develop. Let's assess what's available at Anwar, what's available in Port Thompson, and some of the other areas that might allow production to come on stream that could get the pipeline at least back up to some reasonable level of flow, then we don't have an Arctic strategy for oil and gas.
Wow.
Maybe to put those two together, one of the arguments that people are making for accelerating the approval of LNG exports to help Ukraine is, even if the ships don't hit the water for a few years, the signal that you're sending to the market, and maybe in the case of oil, the more oil on the market is, you know, you put more commodity on the market, you decrease prices. So maybe the connection here is that it could feed into Arctic strategy, not just because of TAPS, but it's important for us to develop onshore and offshore Alaska because it gives the market more liquidity, and there's the national security argument that helps us, that this helps us with our allies, as we see in the case of Russia, right? Because this is one of the main arguments that people are making in the case of Ukraine. So maybe that feeds into the Arctic strategy in that perspective. Let's develop what we have because more oil on the market helps lower prices and keep prices down, and that effectively can help us with our allies.
It comes back to, if you honestly believe that all these projects before LNG projects before DOE are actually going to get built. But we did a study in 2012, which with minor modifications I would stand behind, and we say the U.S. companies that get into the LNG market between now and 2020 will do very well because of the price arbitrage in European, Japanese, and American markets. But after 2020, you have lots of LNG coming into the market from around the world. You probably have some intercontinental pipelines being built, possibly even between Russia and China and Korea's or Japan. You're going to have some other countries, you can argue about which ones, beginning to develop shale gas. And remember, LNG principally competes in power markets, and unless we put a global price on carbon, you're going to have coal being very competitive to LNG, at least in Asian power markets. There are 10 world-class coal projects under construction as we speak that will hit the market starting in 2019 and into the early 2020s. Despite what people think, coal is not dying. It is not going away. The Asian Development Bank just did an assessment projecting that by 2035, coal will be the largest fossil fuel used in the world, more than oil, more than gas. It's not going away. So the people that think after maybe eight, nine, we can argue, let's say we build 10 LNG plants. The people that think 10 through 23 or whatever it is at the moment are going to be built, they won't be able to be financed because the financiers are going to sit there and say, where can you guarantee you have a 60% offtake agreement? As the market evolves the way we foresee it going. So this idea that all of a sudden we just gave 23 licenses, not to mention they still have to get through the FERC process, that this is all going to hit the market, we need to bring some rationality into this debate we've been having on Capitol Hill and the administration, because right now it's not based on facts.
Wow, we have one more question, and I want to end on a slightly more positive note, if we may. who's got the last word? Yes, ma'am, over there. Okay, well, do your best. Thank you.
Nita, you always make it more positive.
This has been a remarkable, totally remarkable discussion and excellent report. Just, I was quite interested, amongst other things, in what you were saying about the company's lack of access, whether it's to the U.S. Government or within the framework of the Arctic Council. How is that going to unfold? And what kind of occurred to me was, in the context of the post-BP spill, the limitations placed on the Oil Pollution Act in terms of liability, caps on liability. And it seems like a question is, so we have at least two or three or four different, or many different perspectives, and it's kind of how to get everyone at the same table willing to put something on it. And so I wonder how, and not to just focus on the industry, because environmental folks, you know, also take certain positions that might be considered hardline. I wonder how does one approach the industry to say, well, maybe don't try to have a limitation on liability caps when there's been an enormous spill with huge impact on environment, on communities, on capacity to engage in economic activity.
Who would like it?
So how do you get the companies at the table on the discussion of insurance and liability?
How do not put a cap.
That is not an issue we looked into specifically. I will tell you that the insurance and liability concept theme came up a lot in terms of our discussion, in terms of the overall governance package addressing offshore oil and gas exploration and production, right? That is one component of the governance regime that needs to be strengthened and needs to be addressed. Essentially, there really isn't very much in place that is similar to what is in place for shipping in general, but not for oil spill liability. There is an example under, I think it's under OSPAR, there is a regional liability scheme that's used for that particular region, but not, it doesn't address all of the Arctic. And the companies are at the table and have signed on to that. I think it's the acronym is OPAL for that, O-P-A-L. It's essentially a regime that the companies operating in that region have agreed to in terms of the approach for insurance and liability. That is not something we specifically looked at. In fact, we specifically took it out. I would recommend the Hoover Institution did a recent excellent report looking at recommendations for strengthening the insurance and liability approach. But that it comes to mind that one particular regional grouping to address insurance in that area is a model that was cited in the Hoover report that might be applicable to the Arctic. And it's a way of bringing the companies together.
And there's been some really excellent work and some early work thinking about how you look at model of regional seas agreements and their applicability to the Arctic, some excellent work that I know my colleague Brooks Yeager and others have been doing. Well, let me say thank you. Again, thank you for allowing me to have
thank
this
you.
Wonderful conversation
thank
with you.
For coming.
Good questions. This education process is working because this is a very informed audience. And again, congratulations. Great report, Charlie, John, Alicia. Well done. And everybody bundle up because it's Arctic outside. So thanks so much. Have a great afternoon.